And we're back.
And we're back, yes. We always say the run-up to Christmas is terrible, but luckily we'll be able to do lots of new content in the new year.
Yes, we often plan to do it actually in the Christmas holiday.
Yeah, and then it turns out that January is over and we haven't recorded anything. But Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year!
It's nice to be back, and we are starting off with a new episode.
Yeah, it's quite a cracker. It's a new series.
It's a whole new series. We are kind of more by coincidence than anything else staying in the same part of the world that we were for the previous series.
Those of you in Radio Vision, probably from the backgrounds, can guess what the topic is.
Yeah, this is a little bit of instructive mise-en-scène. I thought I would start with a little reading to introduce a key turning point in the life of the person that we're talking about.
Should we say this is about buildings and cities?
This is about buildings and cities, podcast. Sometimes with supporting visuals.
Yeah.
I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Kinchel.
And here's a little excerpt from this book by James Ackerman. Andrea Di Pietro della Gondola was apprenticed at 13 to a stone carver in Padua. But in 1524, he broke his contract, fled to nearby Vicenza, and settled there. For the next 14 years, he worked as an apprentice and assistant to the carvers Giovanni da Pedemuro and Girolamo Pittoni, who did most of Vicenza's monuments and decorative sculptures up of this period in an up-to-date style. At 30, Andrea must have been the presumptive heir to this modest enterprise, when he had the good luck to be called to the outskirts of town to work on a new loggia and other additions that the Count Gian Giorgio Trissino had designed for his villa at Criccoli. Trissino was the preeminent intellectual of Vicenza, distinguished for humanistic studies, a writer of drama, poetry, and philological scholarship. He enjoyed sharing his learning and accepted a number of young nobles into his household as students. As an amateur architect, he followed progress on his villa closely, and this brought him into contact with Andrea, whom he decided to house and to educate together with the younger aristocrats. He also gave him the classical name Palladio to crown his elevated status.
I think we've got to the like big thing there quite quickly.
Yeah, so that's a little passage about the key turning point in the life of Andrea Palladio.
Something promising for everyone out there, which is that he didn't even start his architectural education until he was in his 30s.
Yes, previously a stonemason. And for people who haven't heard of him, he was a prominent architect in 16th century Veneto and in Vicenza. I guess part of the reason that we're talking about him is that he has, as Ackerman calls it, been the most imitated architect in history. That the style that he kind of invents in this quite particular context ends up becoming a kind of a model for basically the whole of kind of subsequent neoclassicism to a pretty significant degree.
Its influence is extraordinary. The more I look around, the more I see classical details that really are from Palladio.
He had a huge number of admirers and fans, particularly in kind of 18th century England and America. And to a large extent, Palladianism becomes a sort of kind of house style of the elite of both of those countries.
Yes, think the White House.
Yeah. When we kind of trailed this at the end of the Scarpa episode, or possibly it was the bonus, I was trying out the provocations. Andrea Palladio, working class hero, and Andrea Palladio, the first architect, both of which I think are like slightly stupid, but also have like a bit of truth in them. Like he has a kind of fame and a kind of influence which I don't think really existed for any other architect previously. A lot of that is because of the books that he wrote and the way in which he communicated his work in his books and in a way that allowed them to become like a model that was very easy for people to adapt.
A key way in which he's not the world's first architect is that although he was very successful and influential in his life, he was never internationally or generally famous. He's not known particularly much, I think, outside of his bit of Italy in his lifetime.
Yeah, exactly.
But would become amazingly influential after his death. It's also really good.
Yeah,
they're really good. Like,
so we've been to lots of these, in the villas in particular, and also quite a lot of the other buildings, including together on a kind of cycle trip with a bunch of other friends. Some images from this will be part of the supporting material for this show. But yeah, they are. And they are also, I mean, I should say that, you know, you're introduced to Palladio in the kind of history survey a component of most architecture degrees, I think. And I remember as a student being very unimpressed by the kind of idea of the buildings, finding them quite boring and finding it very hard to understand their attraction. And whereas, you know, you can think of like vaguely contemporary work like Michelangelo's Laurentian Library or something like that. I remember seeing that on a lecture slide and thinking, you know, woof, that's really quite something, which is not, but I really didn't kind of have the same feeling seeing Palladio's work for the same time in images, but visiting it is very different.
And I think actually the image you've got up there is, which would be an absolutely classic lecture slide for Palladio. Yeah. I can remember really bouncing off this one, thinking, this is not, I think, a good gateway drug to Palladio, the Villa Rotonda.
Yeah.
But it's super famous.
I think that one of the, there are various puzzles that we need to try and unravel in our own way. I think that's the biggest one. What is it that's so actually attractive about the buildings when you visit them? What is the kind of specific nature of his genius as an architect? And then there are also sorts of other things which are wrapped around him, his work, the way people think about the work, the way people kind of incorporate or kind of like mythologize it in different ways. You know,
in some ways, it feels to me like a similar experience with Le Corbusier, where when you visit the buildings, they have a charisma which isn't always apparent in the pictures. Although, I guess as I kind of get slightly older, I like appreciate the pictures more as well. And he's a fantastic image maker. And then also someone who there is a barrier of the endless imitators.
Yeah.
You see the clutter of the world in these imitators of this architect, and the imitators often lack the charisma that's present in the original.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the one other thing for me which is really interesting is that, like, the 16th century is both a long time ago and also an extremely kind of modern time in history in lots of ways. And Palladio to me feels like an avatar of modernity. One of Ackerman's like little aperçus is that Palladio is closer to us than he was to the Middle Ages, which in terms of strict chronology is not true, but in terms of the actual content of the work,
yeah, we were just 100% going through a book some images of other villas, and there's stuff being built in his lifetime in the 1530s which looks pretty medieval.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be again.
No.
Although they carry on building in England for another 200 years.
Very, very backward people. Anyway, well, I think we should go on to talking a bit about him and where he comes from. I wanted to say there are various things to get confused about when we're talking about this work. There are lots of duplications. There are lots of villas with two names in particular. There are also lots of names with two villas.
Or three or four.
And there are also various villas with like two versions, like a kind of canonical design and what actually got built, which are kind of different as well. So we're definitely going to get some of that. I would
say that's true of most of them.
We're definitely going to get confused. Well, we'll definitely say some of it wrong.
There's also a really tedious problem about he became so famous that people went to his buildings and tried to make them more Palladian because they thought they'd been mucked up.
Yes.
And only a few of his buildings were finished in his lifetime.
Yeah.
Lots were finished by his successors or not finished.
Yeah.
And authorship is troubled. I think I find these debates like really difficult because I don't know.
Yeah.
It's really hard to tell. People out there in universities and the like are doing great works of scholarship to try and work out what's what.
Yeah.
And I think we'll only engage in that a little bit.
The source I've dipped into more than any other is like a 60-year-old book about him. And I'm aware that lots of the things in it probably have turned out not to be true.
And even really in that, it says, he almost says the same thing in the beginning of that. He says, there's been huge amounts of scholarship. I'm not going to cover it.
Yeah. So we should just say something about this is the part of the world we're in. We're in the Veneto hinterland of Venice, and we're particularly in Vicenza, which is where he'd settled. It's a smaller city, the other side of Padua from Venice, and it's surrounded by all of this. It's got the mountains to the north, but it's otherwise surrounded by all of this wonderfully, what's now wonderfully rich countryside, but which at the time was undergoing a process of agricultural improvement, basically. It's like this is all the Po Delta, the kind of Venetian lagoon, like owes its existence to the fact that the rivers all sort of flow in that direction. But a lot of the land was previously marsh, or in various ways agriculturally not super productive, being used by, you know, wild animals and trees and that kind of thing instead. This is kind of a period where one of the big activities of merchant, patrician, aristocratic families in Venice is buying up land, or kind of acquiring land that they have on terra firma and improving it and making it produce lots of valuable agricultural commodities.
Yes, it's rich, flat farmland, which has many ancient cities in it. So it was always somewhat populated.
Yeah.
And a lot of it had been acquired by Venice in the century running up to Palladio's birth, a time when otherwise the opportunities for Venice in the Mediterranean were becoming more difficult, yeah, and would become more so still.
There's a kind of wider geopolitical picture, which is basically that Venice ends up being hemmed in by the Ottomans at one end and the kind of Spanish at the other, and that they're kind of there.
Yeah, when we were talking about people like Alberti, you've got a sense of lots of competing Italian states.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of them are still sort of there, but it's much less true now. There are big wars fought in the 16th century in Italy, but they are wars mostly between France and Habsburgs, various branches of the Habsburg family, and Venice and the Pope will be involved, but they will certainly by the mid-16th century never really lead anything.
Yeah.
And there's this huge power to the east, the Ottoman Empire, who will also get involved.
Yeah, so Palladio was born in 1508, I guess we should say that. So he's about 35 years younger than Michelangelo. This is the kind of world that he's born into. We should say something about what kind of architecture is around before.
I mean, the other thing with the Veneto is it's not the centre of a lot of what we think of as the Renaissance.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was lots of stuff going on, but it's not Tuscany. It's not even Bologna. And it's got its own traditions, particularly in the city of Venice, producing really brilliant architecture, but not as early to adopt the both literate and kind of mathematical, humanistic traditions of architecture that we saw in Florence earlier.
Yeah, this is a villa built by Giuliano de San Gallo, who confusingly is part one of a huge dynasty of people all called the same thing.
I think the first big one, probably the best of the architects amongst them.
It's commissioned in 1480s, but it was being finished in the 1520s. And it's a villa Medici in Poggio Caiano, which is, you know, around this kind of area that Palladio is going to be building in. And I guess you can say certain things about it, can't you? In some ways, it does prefigure what the Palladian villa is going to be about, because it does things like creating this big sort of podium lair, creates this kind of walking colonnade around the bottom. It has a kind of strong, like, symmetry. But in lots of other ways, it's completely different. And it sort of displays a lot of things which are going to be swept away in the Palladian villa as a kind of paradigm.
I would go back even a step earlier and say, what is a villa? They are large, prestigious houses in the countryside, normally on people's landed estates. They classically contain some mix of a grand house and also the support buildings for working the land. Barns for grain, wine presses, places for horses, places for, you know, raising chickens and doves and whatnot. In this earlier period, they're also somewhat fortified.
Yeah.
this has got a wall around it. Palladian ones are the first generation, really, where they don't have walls around it. It's becoming safe enough that people don't need that level of fortification. This Medici villa is demonstrating that even in the countryside, an interest in sort of strict classical architecture has started.
Yeah.
This is definitely not a Gothic building. Yeah. It's got a temple on it.
On the front.
You can tell. It's got columns.
Yes.
The arcades, this plinth there you were talking about, are very important in Palladian villas. I'm never quite sure how important they are to all the villas.
No.
So a lot of the earlier ones don't have them.
Yeah.
These are space which is used for outdoor working. Northern Italy is more often too hot than too cold, and it's nice to have covered space, covered from the rain and sun, that, you know, agricultural work and storage and things can be done. It's kind of like a veranda.
Yeah, so there's a typology around here that they call a barcessa or barchessa. I can never remember which way you're meant to pronounce it.
No doubt some people on the internet will inform us.
Yes, but which is basically, yeah, it's like a combination of agricultural buildings and this arcading to create the kind of shaded space for working. In the particular case of this house, I'm not sure that that bottom space is actually used for agricultural purposes. I think that it may actually just be more apartments. One of the things which can be resolved in different ways in your villa or in your kind of villa complex is how close at hand is the service, the agricultural use.
And also the domestic service, like, you know, your served versus service spaces. So there's a farm, possibly, usually, and there's also kitchens and...
Yeah. Normally there's a farm because it's part of the reason why you're rich, you know. It's like a very durable form of wealth.
Also, why else would you be out in the countryside?
Well, because it's lovely.
These are... The reason that the owners often want to live there is because they're managing the estate.
Yeah, you've got to keep people on their
which
toes.
Which is slightly different from... You get some Roman villas like that, but it's not like, you know, the Roman villas in Campania where it's like a holiday home.
Yeah.
And you certainly have at this time some sort of, you know, some of the famous Mannerist villas being built further south are more like... holiday homes or party houses for very rich and powerful people. And we're going to talk about a slightly different sort of thing.
Yeah. There's also just a couple of stylistic things about this villa which are noteworthy. There's a lot of decoration, and there's also... But there's a kind of slightly gauche treatment of, like, scale. The little portico on the front looks really little if you're standing away, although I imagine it's rather nicely scaled when you're really up close to it. And there's also, there's a lot of detail, but it's distributed in slightly strange places. Like, there are bits of the plinth which are super detailed. And then there are bits of, there are the bits which sort of seem very blank. But overall, there's a kind of weird relationship between the level of hierarchy and the level of detail.
I would say several things. The generation of buildings before, we've kind of established the idea that you have grids of windows.
Yeah.
And you have that in, you know, your urban palaces, the palazzo. And this one is slightly broken up. It's not completely a grid, but a big wall and a grid looking really stern and imposing was the sort of baseline before this.
Yeah.
And there are villas like that as well.
Yeah.
Some sort of more noble ones. Here we've got a real interest in the classical.
Yeah.
And an attempt to... try out what you can do with Roman architecture, and San Gallo has sort of put a temple on. And this is a quite good villa, but it all doesn't seem kind of resolved.
No.
So you've got the input of the humanistic, you know, I've read books, I've looked at old things. And then I think there's also a story about production and how crafts are used.
Yeah.
Which is that you'd have different teams of people doing it, and presumably... you'd pay a team of people to decorate some part of that plinth.
Yeah.
And that'd be a contract. And they would have some degree of sort of Ruskinian autonomy. Not the workman, but the workshop would.
Yeah.
And that seem to harm the unity of the whole scheme.
They've managed to keep it symmetrical, but the coordination, I would say, could be worked a little bit harder. And it's one of the real things we're going to see in Palladio is that He's someone who has a series of techniques for understanding the design of a building in all of its particulars as a whole and coordinating the scale of everything in like an exceptionally kind of effective and unified way.
Yeah, this is an interesting example because it's not exactly what most of the houses being built in the countryside in the Veneto was like just before this, but I think it illustrates the problems of we haven't quite worked out how to do the classical villa yet.
Yeah, this one is much, at least this one is
very grand.
It's trying to do a classical villa. Lots of the other ones are actually doing a sort of fruity gothic kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's more acceptable to be old fashioned in the countryside, isn't it? I mean, that's sort of as true now as ever.
Yeah.
If you're being a bit military as well, if you're being a bit defensive, that sort of feels more old. You know, you can crenellate your walls and things. They were very much doing that. Even in humanistic terms, the rustic, things going on in the countryside, are kind of more tough and plain. And that's another sort of set of inputs. If you look at the background of you know, Giorgione paintings or Titian sort of landscapes, you see kind of barns, big things with little, with square stone towers in the background. It's kind of rough and hard. And that's, I think, the idea of this rich, ideal countryside.
Yeah, that's what it's like.
Here's a picture. So he's a bit older.
This is the man. So we're looking at a picture of the man himself. It is very interesting. It's obviously not unknown. Lots of people have these stories of their lives being transformed in various ways. Famously, you know, like Cimabue was drawing on rocks with charcoal or something as a shepherd boy. But it is kind of interesting.
Is that Cimabue? I thought that was Giotto.
Maybe that's Giotto.
Cimabue picked up Giotto, but perhaps I was wrong.
Maybe.
And Bramante's got a story a bit like that as well. Yeah. And I guess even Michelangelo was kind of picked up by the Medicis.
Yeah. You kind of get inducted into this aristocratic world of, of kind of contact with all of these wonderful riches of antiquity, all the books, all the learning, all the opportunity to travel and to see all kinds of marvellous things.
An unusual feature of Palladio is it happened to him later in life. Yeah. Than, you know, these other people are picked up in their teens.
Yeah.
And he's got a steady job.
Yeah.
He's 30 or 31.
There's not that many examples of the stuff he was working on in his job before architecture, but there are various little monuments and things around Vicenza that you can look at.
There's a little bit of church front. Yeah,
very decorative, very nice.
Classical. They often have pediments on top, pediments and arches. So he'd broken the contract with one stoneworker, gone to Vicenza, got a job in this firm of, like, they would do architectural stonework and monuments. You want a new gate for the church in a classical style, or a tomb, or a little altarpiece, some ecclesiastical furniture. They would have the capacity, I'm sure, to handle drawings in that, because this work is very precise.
Yeah, I think there were two partners, and one was more of was thought to be more of an architect, and one is thought to be more of a sculptor, like that kind of that kind of partnership.
But I'm sure everyone was doing it, and I'm sure that the design work would be preparing very much working drawings of how individual stones fit together to make these seamless pieces of work, and an understanding of how the kind of building up process of creating something which looks so finished and so untouched by, you know, that doesn't seem like something that someone's just sort of made rustically. It's very un-Gothic, isn't it? This, even if we're, I suppose the Renaissance has been going for quite a long time now. It's kind of professionalized.
Yeah. This kind of first famous patron of his, Gian Giorgio Trissino, there are things about the relationship which I think reoccur in other ones as well. I think one of them is that the patrons are also like big intellectual mentors in certain ways, and they are also kind of collaborators. Like he's often the relationship is that the patron is a sort of amateur architect, or they're kind of intellectuals who have a real interest in kind of architectural projects of some kind. And I think a lot of his attraction as an architect to them is his capacity to kind of collaborate and work with them and kind of bring things together and deliver.
Particularly at this point, they can offer things to him.
Yeah, enormous amount.
Because, I mean, not just financially, not just in terms of circumstance, but, you know, he's from an ordinary background. He hasn't got a classical education, not at all. Not only can he not go to Rome or go to look at all these things, he hasn't. These are all sort of bits that are kind of outlying bits of the Venetian Empire, which had at one time or another been independent cities, but that often meant that the, like, centre of the most modern things were not being done there.
Yeah.
And so they offer a window. These well-educated, well-travelled, rich, cultured aristocrats offer a kind of way into that world intellectually as well as in terms of just having the resources to do it.
Yeah, we should
also patronage network, extremely important. They're all introducing him to each other and the community of aristocrats. I think he's a useful thing in that he's just... They are, to an extent, competing, as well as murdering each other in the streets, which these people are still very capable of doing. It's not modern life. These are... Kind of got to remember that. But they are also competing to be cultured people.
Yeah, I do think... So to say something about Trezzino, he's like the traditional sort of humanist. He's like a person who... He's got lots of classical learning. He loves the vanished world of Greece and Rome.
Especially the idea of it.
Yeah. And he wants to bring it back.
Yeah.
And he writes lots of... Kind
turgid,
of,
turgid
lots
place.
Lots of literary works. People do not say they're very good. but they are...
Epic poetry that... That even the people who write about Palladio do not seem to have read.
Yeah, but
certainly not all the way through.
And he's a very he is not so much looking for kind of innovation. He is looking to do things properly and to, you know, bring the
true believer.
He's a true believer in classicism. He wants to bring it back.
And classicism from books, I would say.
Yeah, he had various sort of schemes. He also had schemes about changing how Italian was written. He wanted to bring in lots of letters from Greek. And that kind of thing. A scheme in which he was partly successful.
Oh, what letters did they get?
Mainly Z was the one that he was successful on. That using Z instead of T for various things is one of his legacies.
Yeah. Well, we'll see later on in Palladio's books that there's only 20 letters in the Latin alphabet. So those are all the letters he can use for labelling up his diagrams.
Yeah.
And if there's more than 20 things... He doesn't label them.
Well, that's enough. That's surely enough.
So it's missing. But he has got, yes.
So the story about Palladio and Trezzino may well not actually be true. I think it's disputed by lots of people. And it's definitely the case that there's no real evidence of any of his work in the house, which is described in that little story, which is this one at Crickley.
Well, I mean, the firm that he was working for was contracted to do some stonework for it.
Yeah.
That bit is true. And so he would have seen it.
Yeah.
It seems to me rather unlikely that he would have designed it.
Yeah.
Because he was a stonework contractor.
Yeah.
There's several things we should say about this house. So this is a villa for Trezzino. It's in the countryside. And it's not a new villa. It's a revamp of an old house core.
Yeah.
And the old house is a very long-standing type, which is a box with four boxy towers in the corner.
Yeah.
Not quite as tall as it's wide. And so it's a square with square towers on the corners. There are examples of this sort of thing from all the way back as late antiquity in this part of the world. And I guess people build them when the land is safe enough to build that sort of thing on. And what Trezzino is doing... is he is taking a bit of a wall between two of the towers on one side and making a classical front on it in a style that was already quite established. It's got arches and Ionic columns on the ground, Ionic pilasters on the ground floor. Looks very much like it could be taken out of one of Sebastiano Serlio's illustrations of that order. And above, there's Corinthian pilasters, and there's some stuck-on plaster figures, and windows with pediments on top. And it looks a bit like the central section could be taken out of a copybook.
Yeah.
It would really have to basically be Serlio's, because there weren't really any others at that point.
Yeah, that was the one.
It doesn't have lots of the things that Palladio will do later.
Yeah.
And the whole building doesn't look... I mean, I think this is one where they've tidied it up lots and lots and tried to make it more Palladian as well. But it doesn't look like a harmonious thing. It looks like a thing's been inserted in an old building, which is exactly what's happened.
Yes. In particular, there is a relationship between the position of the windows in the towers and the symmetrical centre of the mass of the towers, which does rather give you the willies if you're...
Yeah,
in the habit of looking out.
I mean, they also, for example, don't look. Something which is very classical is to have your buildings, and not very Gothic, is to have your buildings built to measurements which are consistent.
Yeah.
So, I think if we went back a little bit earlier, it'd be pretty unusual for there to be a plan of a villa drawn up that was then accurately followed.
Hmm.
I don't think it'd be very often that, you know, there'd be a plan and the plan would have like a measurement of how wide the room must be, and then there'd be a room built to a precise measurement like that. And you can sort of see it. They're both sets of windows are off-centered, but by slightly different amounts.
Yeah.
And I reckon if you went round with a tape measure, you discovered that all of the rooms are inconsistent and not quite plumb and square.
Yeah. So this is happening in the mid-late 1530s. This is when his life is sort of changing. The other big thing which Trissino did was he took Palladio to different places, probably to Padua to hang out with kind of various people there, and definitely to Rome, which he visited on multiple occasions over the next 2 decades.
He met a whole series of people in Padua, including Cornaro, who would be an important patron later on.
Yeah. And really that kind of contact with Rome and that contact with
First trip to Rome?
I think 1541 is what the date I've got here.
Okay,
there's some building before then, but you can start to see the things which he's seen and which he's kind of drawn and understood.
I think you'll feel a big difference between the things.
Yeah.
He designs a couple of villas before then, and we'll notice a big change and a big step up in maturity towards his established style once he goes to Rome.
I think we could move on to talking about the kind of canonical first big villa, which is the Villa Goddi, which was built for 3 landowning brothers. It was probably started in 1537 and concluded in maybe 1542.
Which is remarkable. That implies that it was finished.
Yeah. Well, lots
in quite short order.
Yeah. I don't know. People were capable of it.
Yeah, they did. They did. This is generally not what happens with the others, though.
Yeah. And it's a good illustration. We do need to define, there's something distinctive about a Palladian villa, which is different from the general villa in the countryside. And this is, I think, a good way to start to do it.
This has got the beginning of it.
Yeah.
So the first thing that marks out a villa by Palladio is that I think that they're really good. And I think this one is really cool. Look at that. I mean, you can't, unless you're, this is a good reason to, I guess, watch them on the internet, but you can also look it up on the social media.
Yeah.
This is a great facade, and it's really stark.
Yeah.
So one thing I think that makes things Palladian is a really strong use of proportional systems.
Yeah.
Proportions. You might not immediately be able to see, that's a golden section or whatever, but you can immediately see that it's got an interesting arrangement of rectangles, which is not what you do if you weren't thinking about it. It's very much not a grid like the earlier Renaissance. It's startling, sharp, and exciting.
Yeah, so it's got the kind of main front facade is broken down into 3. There's a kind of narrower bit in the middle, which is recessed, and there's a symmetrical bit on either side, which is
It's very much a take on that earlier block house, like, you know, cuboidal house with 4 towers, except the towers have become
much fatter,
very fat, not any taller than the rest of the building, and seem much more like just a part of the even part of the facade.
Yeah, and the two side bits are sort of they're a bit taller than square. They're kind of individually, they've got this symmetrical layout of windows, but which isn't a sort of even grid. It's a like 1-2-1 pattern, which is then repeated on each of the 3 floors with little ones in the attic. I wanted to say something about what's going on in villas generally, which is that there's something which is kind of read, which is sort of taken over from the palazzo as a type in Venice, which is that the main living quarters in these villas is on the first floor, not the ground floor.
It's the nicest one.
Yeah, well, it is.
Away from the muck and mire and smells, but not so high, you have to go up loads of stairs.
Yeah.
Better light, good views out of the principal rooms.
Yes, but that would not be necessarily typical of all kind of villas or houses in the countryside. I think that that's something which is kind of a distinctive of this type in particular.
Yes. I mean, so something that does go on with his villas, and I think to an extent this is part of just moving a posh house into the countryside.
Yeah.
Is that they're typically got three stories that you can kind of identify. The ground floor is often rugged, rather like the kind of rusticated base of one of those palazzo, but not in that, and is lower. And that can be for storage. I mean, it can be subterranean.
Yeah.
There's a first floor, which in the English sense. Which is tall, light, has the beautifully decorated rooms, the reception rooms, bedrooms. And then there's a top floor, which is short, has little windows, will have rooms for servants, more storage, that sort of thing. And then there's another thing, which is that his buildings are always symmetrical. He will strive a lot to make a building symmetrical, even when it's difficult. And in the countryside, it's fairly straightforward making a building symmetrical.
And most importantly, it is symmetrical from the front.
Yes.
What he's interested in more than anything is like axial symmetry when looking at the elevations perpendicular, like looking straight onto things. Yeah. And although his buildings are, when you experience them, they're like very three-dimensional and they work wonderfully in very three-dimensional ways.
Yeah.
That sounds very banal, but it's not.
Well, no, I mean, being able to really handle three dimensions is surprisingly unusual.
Yeah.
Many people today, even with much more easy to use tools for three-dimensional imaging, don't get it right.
Yeah. But he's like the way he likes to kind of work the design, or certainly the way he kind of presents his like working of the design, is all about two-dimensional elevations, particularly in the villas, and the way that those are sort of resolved head on. He does also present this book, this villa later on in his, his most famous book is The Four Books on Architecture, which contain, one of the books is all about the villa and it's illustrated with examples of his own work. And he tends to present slightly kind of ideal or kind of completed versions of the designs rather than whatever state they happen to be in at that moment, not unreasonably. And there is a presentation of the Villa Goddi. It's a little bit different from how it is in real life.
There's several important differences. I wanted to say another... I'll try and be quicker. I think we're being a bit slow with scrubs on this. But also, his symmetry, it's always that you've got a central thing, which is normally like the big prestigious thing, and then wings on that, and then wings and wings and wings going out.
Yeah.
And then often ending... Ideally, he likes to end with something like a little tower at the ends.
Yeah.
So this is a very classic one. There's a central tallest bit of the villa.
Yeah.
Then there's the two towery bits of the villa. And then he's got sort of barn-like wings just coming out as a single story.
Yeah.
And then he's got a loggia going beyond that, or a wall. And then he's got two sort of dovecotty like rows of agricultural buildings beyond that.
Yeah.
Just making this thing. And it might seem basic, but this idea of a sort of reflected set of different things in hierarchy that reflect on the two sides, I think is really important to what he does.
Yeah, it is.
A second thing I want to say about this is it's really interesting what he's changed in the facade, because the actual facade of Villa Goddi is much more exciting than what he's drawn as his ideal one. The actual one has got this really stark arrangement of windows on the facade, which I find really exciting.
Yeah.
When I was, you know, like in my late teens or early 20s, and I first saw, this was like one of the things that I found most exciting of all of the projects of Palladio. This like weird proportional, it seems so starkly modern.
Yeah.
Like, oh, at last, like Michelangelo, he's doing something transgressive.
Yeah.
This seems really weird.
Yeah.
And he's not included that. And I thought that might be something he was taking from Venice. Now, there's some things that are very un-Venetian. So a lot of the buildings from before this time in Venice that are prestigious Renaissance buildings are excitingly and deeply asymmetrical.
Yeah.
Which I find so interesting. And he completely rejects that.
Yeah.
But this uneven arrangement of windows, which you get a lot in Venetian buildings earlier, and I think in there just comes from the flexibility you get when you're sitting on pile foundations.
Yeah.
You can imagine the building is being made much more, even when it's made of stone walls, yeah, much more as an arrangement of columns and then spanning between, like you get with timber frame buildings, where you can put, you know, the Dutch timber frame buildings, put whacking great windows right on the corner,
yeah,
because the whole thing's being held up by a post. And I think this freedom to have buildings very near the edge of the wall,
yeah,
and then very, yeah, close to each other feels like an adoption of almost vernacular practice from Venice.
Yeah.
But what they don't do is make it so austerely and starkly proportional, or like interested in a proportional grid.
Yeah, there's very.
He doesn't represent that in his drawn-up project in the four books at all.
No, he's changed the arrangement of the windows. Yeah, it's very stark, isn't it? Very, very little on the facade. This is something which is kind of consistent all the way through. There's this sort of stucco. There's the openings of the windows are, but and of the kind of loggias and arcades and things are by far the most kind of prominent element on the.
Here's a really minor thought. I thought that the Palladians in England paint the window frames white.
Yes.
And that's much weaker.
Yes.
Here, it's also the Italian light.
It all becomes very frilly as a result.
The Italian light is like really strong, but the window, all the sort of timber work that makes up a window is either black or more often just oiled.
Yeah.
So it's like very dark. Matt, wood, yeah, with a wood finish,
yeah,
and that means that, like on his drawings, the windows read black against white,
yeah,
and it makes all of this play of proportions much more stark because, it just so much more graphically exciting,
yeah,
than this kind of lace work of, yeah, little windowy bits.
So I think that that is, yeah, I think that this one does capture. In the drawn scheme, it does kind of capture the aspiration of the Palladian villa, that you have the house and that you have the farm, but that everything is integrated into a kind of complete architectural composition that holds all of those parts together. And that he never tries to do something which I think other architects in other schemes tried to do, of just putting the work stuff somewhere discreetly out of sight. It's always integrated into and kind of and contained within
and used, yeah, for grandeur.
Yeah.
Like, why would you give up on all this building mass?
Yeah.
You can arrange this building mass like geometrically and excitingly and use it to make your house look so much grander.
Yeah, no, it's good.
There are a couple of things that this villa doesn't have that a Palladian villa has in, yeah, the high period. It has no classical ornament.
Yeah.
There's no orders, there's no column capitals. There's no sculpture,
yeah,
which we'll see lots and lots of later. And this is before he went to Rome. I guess that was the main one.
Yeah.
That was my, well, like it doesn't have any of, like, the windows. What's something really exciting about those windows? He's done a corb. There's no,
yeah,
pediment on top.
Yeah.
There's no nothing. It's just, like, there's no drip detail.
Yeah.
It's just a thing cut. It's pure geometry.
Yeah.
Primal geometry. Really exciting.
Yeah,
it does have like some arches on piers.
Yeah,
it does have symmetry, but it's funny. It feels like the most modern thing in Palladio happens like right at the beginning before he's done anything.
Yeah,
which is that this is going to be done on a module. You don't need any ornament. It can be pure geometry. I need no classicism. This is all about space and volume.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That, can you think of anyone earlier in the history of architecture that has done that in Europe?
Well, then maybe that's one for the listeners.
It seems extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
Because lots of people have, you know, Brunelleschi has stunning proportions.
Yeah.
Like, you go into the Pazzi Chapel, so...
Yeah.
It's so good. But it still, it is always and has to be dressed up classically appropriate. There's a lot of effort goes into understanding how to use orders to go around a corner.
Yeah.
This is like, no, it's just plaster. This is just white stuff. I don't care what's in the wall.
Yes. Well, I wonder. I mean, it's so hard to know what the intentions are and
what's just
the way that it ends up.
But he drew it. He could draw it however he wanted. And sure, the thing he drew up isn't as exciting.
Yeah.
But it is just that. It is just pure form.
Yeah.
There's like no intention there to do anything other than that.
There's one other house from that kind of pre-Rome visit period, which is like another very strange, very minimal facade. This is one of the lesser Valmarana villas.
It's a really small project. It's basically known, like it's physically small. It's so stark.
Yeah.
So,
and the profile is kind of like an agricultural shed profile. It looks like the end of...
Yeah, but it feels almost like that Venturi house.
Yeah, yeah, it's like kind of Vanna Venturi kind of profile, like shallow pitched roof. And then it's got...
Well, the plan is square.
Yeah.
It's like a square with a shallow pitch, and there's like one window on each side, and there's a little arch with a door.
Yeah.
And the middle bit is recessed just like... You know, 10 centimeters, and there's the notion of a broken pediment, and there's nothing else on the front, and on the back there's just a really strict arrangement of small windows on a big white facade. Really exciting. I want to talk more about this in the extra villas bonus.
Ah, yes.
So the beloved patrons.
Yeah, they can have a, they can have a bit of that.
More of my thoughts on this one, which I think is a really interesting one.
I think we should sort of pause there and maybe try and sum up a little bit, and then we can have another episode where we go through the chronology of the villas, talk about some of the main villas.
It feels wrong to call this like juvenilia.
Yeah.
I mean, firstly, because he's kind of old, he'd obviously been thinking about how to do shapes and stuff before then, because these are... Very mature, wouldn't you say?
Something which he seems to have had from the start is that they are very rigorously planned out, proportional, like highly... Again and again, I'm going to come to this idea of like coordination. Like, is one of the key sort of terms of art in like buildings are extremely complex, not to say rather chaotic projects.
Mm.
And one of the big things is to keep all of the... sort of have all of the decisions that you've made and work out the relationship between all of them and somehow manage to manifest, make all of them happen without anything making something else impossible or messing it up or someone doing something on site which then makes something impossible. You know,
it's kind of integrating the problem of the building, right? There's the practical problems of the building, and there's also like the aesthetic, you know, it's got to look good from all the angles.
Yeah, you kind of be able to go around it. There's a sort of aesthetic problem of it, and then there's the question of, yeah, like how you integrate this imponderably large mass of like decisions and actions in order to produce this almost invariably unique object like correctly. And that's really difficult. That's why integration and coordination, you know, these are like it ultimately, you know, they're sort of what being an architect is about, actually, is being good at those things and understanding how to do them in very imperfect circumstances.
And he creates like a big chunk of the set.
Yeah.
And he does it so rapidly.
Yeah.
Of solutions for how to do classical architecture, as we know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
guess the other thing is that even in these early ones, he's showing also that you can have big effects with quite limited decorative means.
Yeah.
That he's very, even in the more mature ones where he's really trying stuff out and he's like recreating temples and all these sorts of things, he's still quite sparing in which bits are highly decorated. And he's very happy to allow large areas to be like extremely minimal, extremely pragmatic. And it's that ability to sort of shepherd your resources and use them in certain places also strikes me as being like very much a sign of architectural maturity that exists from the start.
When I found this Valmarana villa is not super famous.
Mm.
To the extent that it's famous because it's got his first use of the Surliana or Palladian window.
Yeah.
Which is something we know from, which he didn't invent, but it's like
you've
got two columns with an arch, and then on either side of them you've got an opening, which could be a window.
Yeah.
But that's almost the only thing in this. And it was really exciting and interesting to me because I'd seen Villa Gaudí, but it's like one thing on its own. It's one project.
Yeah.
And he's someone who's capable of working in a number of styles. This one as well, next to it, just feels like it's more of a pattern where at the beginning of his career, he's got this idea about, we're just going to use brick walls rendered white and I'm going to make shapes with them. And even if I don't have any extra money to play with anything else, you don't have to.
Yeah,
that on its own can give you everything you need to do something extremely exciting and new. And that feels very something that you can read as modern, even though that's like anthropomorphizing or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like putting
our mind there.
We're kind of projecting massively, but yeah.
But it feels really exciting. That's like the first thing he does.
Yeah.
The first thing he does is like what in a way feels like the most radical step, because it doesn't feel like for me any amount of like, oh, you could put a temple on a temple, which is kind of what a certain amount. We'll have a lot of that discussion about how you could put a temple on a temple. I'm really into that too. But to have this like, you can do it with nothing. You can just do it with mass and space, boxes, pitch roofs, and you can just like strip it down to something so simple, and so powerful. Oh,
it's
very exciting. Also, I think massively projecting. I don't have enough to like make a basis of this, check it out.
Check it out. Check it out. So, as ever, we'll have a lot of supporting material on our various social media channels. We're generally about _buildings. And we will be producing bonus material for this project, as with all of our shows. I think we're going to use the bonuses to explore some of the villas we don't get to, some of the wilder and wackier ones, and also
He does, spoiler, lots of villas. We're going to cover a quarter of them in the main episodes, and every single one of them has a new good idea.
Yeah.
Every single one.
We're also going to kind of spread out a bit into the kind of inheritance, the influence, the Palladians of various kinds. We're going to get Matt on certainly for some of that because it's his particular field of expertise. And you can get access to bonus material, if you so desire, by supporting our Patreon, which is also patreon.com/about_buildings.
Thank you
very much for listening or watching, and we'll be with you again very soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah.